Hello, folks. This is your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. Before we begin today's episode, we have a special announcement. Please come join us for the 2024 Triad Summit Series. Mark your calendars for May 17th from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Pacific Time. This event is online and is completely free to attend. At this one-day summit, you'll have the opportunity to learn from two esteemed experts as they share valuable strategies for addressing the mental health crises that we are in, aiding in trauma recovery, stress management, and helping individuals reach their highest potential. Don't miss this chance to connect with innovators in mental health, gaining insights from industry leaders, and fostering connections within the wider wellness community. Learn more and reserve your spot today at triadhq.com/TSS. That's triadhq.com/TSS. I hope to see you at the summit.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. Have you ever said or maybe heard another say one of these phrases, "On the inside, I'm a fraud. I'll never be good enough to deserve this. I'm not as talented as they think. I don't want to ask questions because it will show how little I might just really know. I'm not capable of doing this. Oh, that was nothing. I'm sure my teammate could have done the same thing. Or maybe I don't offer anything really special to the company that no one else could add." If you said one of these things before or heard another voice one, there's a possibility you were experiencing a moment of feeling like an imposter. While we might all feel some aspects of these phrases, there are some whose lives are lived through these beliefs, the beliefs that they are really an imposter. We're here today to discuss the imposter syndrome with me as a return guest, Dr. Regan Shriver. Regan is the associate professor of practice at the University of Tennessee's College of Social Work, where he teaches clinical and leadership courses. And he's also the director of the MSSW program, Knoxville Campus, and the chair of the Forensic Social Work Certificate Program. In addition to his work in academia, Regan also serves as the special assistant to the president of the Catholic Charities USA to develop integrated health programs within their network. We're excited to have Regan with us today to discuss the imposter syndrome, the different ways the imposter syndrome shows up in our lives, and some of the ways to effectively deal with it. Regan, welcome back to our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you on the show. One of our favorite guests, and you bring such a nice energy to the show. So, I want to jump in here. I gave some examples in the introduction of some things that we can say to ourselves that would possibly indicate the imposter syndrome. But what are some of the actual things we're talking about? When we say imposter syndrome, what exactly are we talking about when we use this term?
Can I give two quotes from people that I was super surprised to hear that sort of came from this perspective, or this phenomenon? The one is from Albert Einstein. And he said, "The exaggerated esteem in which my life work is held makes me ill at ease. I feel compelled to think of myself as an involuntary swindler," which was kind of surprising to me. I would never have thought that. And then from Maya Angelou, she said, "I've written 11 books, but with each time I think, uh-oh, they're going to find out now. Yeah. I've run a game on everybody." And I thought of those two quotes as just embodying really what I think the imposter syndrome or imposter phenomenon is, summed up in those two quotes.
When you mentioned those two people, I mean, those are standout marquee people that have just made such an impression in our lives. And then for them to be able to say, so it's this condition, isn't it, of feeling anxious and not experiencing success internally, despite being high-performing in very measurable, objective ways. I mean, it's right there. And yet they still feel, like you said, in both of these cases, like a fraud or a phony, almost kind of doubting their abilities in the way that they deserve to be.
To me, reading about this and my experience with them, working with people, students in supervision and others that are getting their license, that are new to the field, I feel like that's probably the most common. But I think us that have been in the field for forever still have some of these issues too. That it's more than just, "I'm not sure," or maybe "I have self-doubt." It's more than that. I feel like it's deeper. and even maybe like not just situation specific to where, you know, I mean, maybe I don't feel comfortable in my role at work, but maybe I don't feel comfortable in my family. You know, there can be sort of like an across situations that people may feel this deep like thing. And an analogy I was kind of thinking about, I just came to my head, was that I feel like maybe if I'm trying to disguise myself as a tiger and I'm in a cage and then trying to fake that I'm a tiger when really I'm a human, really food for the tigers, you know, that's scary as all get out. What if they find out? What if they smell me out? What if they, you know, notice that I'm not acting, you know, that there's that kind of level of fear and anxiety that can be associated with it.
I think what you're anchoring right there is a really important concomitant piece to this. It's fear-based. It's not just, you know, feeling a little anxious about something. It's a deeply entrenched, fear-based, uncertainty-based. And what you mentioned a moment ago was, it's not just about something situational or assessing a situation. It's how someone literally assesses themselves in such a distorted view. And you're talking right now, as we're talking about the anxiety piece, what are some of the feelings and maybe some of the symptoms that might be associated with this imposter syndrome that might help maybe someone listening to the show realize that, hey, maybe I'm experiencing something along these lines? What do we tend to notice?
I think off the top of my head, a couple of things that maybe a fear to say no. Like if I say no, they're going to realize that I don't know what I'm doing. Or if I say no, then that indicates that they'll never ask me again. I don't have a, you know, I think that fear of saying no, which then leads to, I think, is blurred with the idea of not having very clear or very active boundaries, you know, in our lives, that we're like, okay, like, where do I begin and this ends? Like, and what other people need from me becomes more important than what I believe I can offer. To me, it feels like another sort of core feeling that the other person's needs trump my own, what I can offer, who, you know, what I am. Mm-hmm. Thinking about like a generalized anxiety, but then I think there's also some organizational things that we could talk about, like, you know, as well.
Well, name a couple of those. What comes to mind?
Like, I think one of the things I think about, like, you know, having been the head of an agency at kind of where there were behavioral health providers and things like that, that there sometimes I feel like absenteeism and maybe people reluctant because they get so fearful that like I can't do this. So then that ends up maybe people aren't showing up for work, either physically or sort of emotionally too. So it's like there's some organizational things that how do we as a, like maybe as organizations address these issues as well, rather than just me as an individual?
Yeah, I think it's a really great point. What you're talking about right now are ways that this could be manifest. And I hadn't thought coming into the show, but it makes total sense and it clicks very quickly now that you've mentioned it. When we think about the imposter syndrome and maybe some ways that one might identify whether or not they experience some of this, you know, like you said, it's that sense of inadequacy or self-doubt. Sometimes people feel like there's, you know, time is running out, you know, it's only a matter of time, or like I'm putting, like you said, but like I'm putting on an act and they can't keep the act together much longer. At some point they're going to realize that my next book is going to be the one that outs me, you know, kind of thing. Or, and even what you just mentioned right there, maybe even sabotaging success. So maybe one doesn't show up for work or for that important meeting. And here these self-sabotaging things because they're afraid that they can't live up to these expectations that they feel have been put on them. You brought up a thing around boundaries, and I hadn't thought about this piece right here, but imagine, because usually when we think about the imposter syndrome, we think about those within a work setting, or we think about those maybe within a performance-based thing, someone who's up on stage giving talks. That's, you know, performance anxiety, imposter syndrome, et cetera, or someone like, you know, Einstein or, you know, Angela, who's putting together these works that are out in the public. But think about, when you put it this way, think about maybe just even people's personal relationships, even dating relationships, where someone doesn't feel a self-worth. Like I'm, like the person that they think they're dating really isn't who I am. And what if they find out? So maybe I don't have good boundaries. Because if I had good boundaries, they may not see me as of worth, and that imposter syndrome is going to be proven true. So maybe my worth and my value, because I question them, aren't going to show up in healthy boundaries in the person that I'm dating. I hadn't thought about the boundary piece, but I really like what you're raising there.
Thanks. You know, I think too, sometimes that the driver being, if the other people really have the ticket and I'm just in on a fake ticket, you know, if I'm just that, like, I think about this can show up, like, I feel like in teaching, you know, me being a teacher, like all these students know what's going on and they know the material and they already know, and I'm just faking it. And just when the hand goes up, oh, this is going to be the one that's going to expose me as a fraud, you know, that I really don't know what I'm talking about. Kind of what you're saying. That's living on eggshells.
It's really that narrative, like you're saying. It's the narratives that we weave about our own personal sense of ourselves. I know that they oftentimes will talk about the four P's related to imposter syndrome: people pleasing, mm-hmm. perfectionism, mm-hmm. paralysis, and then procrastination. You know, mm-hmm. we'll put some things off, all in the service of maybe if I hide, they won't see really who I really am. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fear based.
It is fear based, and then you are just like, okay, when's it going to drop off? And then I think that there's not to jump to the healing part yet, but I do feel like that if we can become aware of, you know, where are those triggers? Where are the little landmines, you know, that sort of like trigger that anxiety, like the thing about being asked a question, or maybe at my job, like, okay, you're going to get a promotion. You've done such a good job here that we're going to give you a promotion. And I think that sometimes that's where that self-sabotage thing can come in, where, oh, I'm not going to take the promotion because, you know, they're going to find out I can't do the job I'm in.
You know, when you put it like that too, I think about how incapacitating this can really be. So let's say we're in our job and we want to work hard, we want to advance. But each advancement, the way you're just putting it right there, each advancement presents a new challenge for me. Like Maya's book. What if the next book is the one they find out about me? What if mm-hmm. what if they finally discover? What if in this next advanced position they put me into is the one where I really reveal myself and they kind of go, oh, wait a minute, Graham, he's really not all that. We thought he was, we advanced him, and now the gig is up. There's mm-hmm. there's going to be a real fear, isn't there, around maybe even the level of work you might put in, because you want to do a good job, but you're afraid that if I do, what then? What if I get promoted? Yay, whoa, same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then they're all kind of trying to stay in the corner or something like that. Yeah. A couple of things too, I feel like maybe even another layer. Say if we are, as a white man, I feel like sometimes a door might open that wouldn't. But so say a door opens or a promotion opens for someone who's minoritized, and then maybe sometimes we'll feel like, okay, I'm an imposter or whatever. But then I also carry the burden of all other people in my category. You know, that if they discover me as the failure that I think I already am, and then is that going to mean something for everyone else that's in my same, you know, group, whatever that group is?
Well, we talk about the pressure of kind of having those things on your shoulders. I'm going to be the one that kind of gets out in front and maybe is a representative of everyone like me. You're raising a great point. We know that there are groups with reportedly a higher prevalence of imposter syndrome, like students, minority groups, like you're mentioning. It's higher in females and some select workforce members, like in high pressure, you know, high stakes settings. We know this particularly prevalent in those that are in the healthcare profession. I've been in the healthcare profession. I've watched interns and residents and fellows come through, and they are expected to know so much. And I'm sure even in your training, because you're at the University of Tennessee with students coming through, and you've got to see that those in healthcare professions feel this great responsibility to have people's lives in their hands. And they're going, I so want to help, but I'm so afraid. What if I am not capable to? What even maybe might you notice in your students sometimes?
A couple things. How high the stakes really are, I think in some ways, high the stakes are. And then maybe sometimes minimizing the stakes, you know, like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. If, you know, but then I think the paralyzing part is, wow, this is someone's life. They're extremely depressed. I'm having to provide a therapeutic intervention for them. And I'm not really sure I know how to do this, but I'm going to pretend I do, or, you know. And I think sometimes maybe the system is a little unfair. I think we put people in roles sometimes too soon. I think sometimes our students are in their internships or whatever. Are we putting them in something too soon where they're not really ready for it, and then setting them up to pretend that they're something that they're not? You know?
I think that's a really important piece in that. I think there are ways to minimize this, particularly those, like you said, in high-performing, high-stakes situations, to recognize maybe a readiness to be put in that position and ways to consider that. So it's a good fit in terms of timing. What else are you seeing maybe in ways that can show up in our work environments, or some things that might kind of amplify maybe one's experience of this imposter syndrome? Have you noticed anything yourself? Or
a couple of things I think that people will have a feeling that it'll just go away, that the more I'm in this, the more it'll go away. But like, I don't want to be without hope. But I think, you know, all things can get better. But I do think sometimes if you're seeing this in your dating relationships, if you're seeing a little bit of this in your family, if you're seeing that it's not going to go away on its own. Like, it's not just a cold that's going to wear itself out. We need to do something. We need to reach out. That's one thing that comes up. And another thing that comes up is, to me, is comparing ourselves. You know, like, I think sometimes, like, I find I'm in this academic setting where there's a whole lot of smart people. And I find myself like, oh my goodness, like, I'm not going to say a thing, because then they're going to find out that I am not like this. I think, like, just that comparison thing, you know, I know stuff that, like, other faculty don't know, because many of them have gone directly, have been in academics for a long time. And so maybe I might have some experiences that some of them might have, but I completely discount that because I've compared myself to people that know statistics way better than I do and stuff like that, you know? So I think that's a common thing, that comparison.
Yeah. Well, expand that piece right there, because I think comparison is the thief of the ability to truly own what we might bring uniquely and differently from other people. And we discount it. Talk about that comparison piece being really kind of one of the cornerstone pieces of the imposter syndrome.
I think one of the things I see a lot of students, number of students that are more introverted or just naturally, they're just not as verbal. Like, what they're thinking isn't immediately coming out of their mouth, like some of us. And so I think sometimes it's the folks that are a bit more extroverted that are saying stuff and putting their ideas out there. And then an introverted person just will, like, I've seen this in people that will say, I can never compare to that. Like, that level of energy, that level, I just can't be there, do that, you know, that kind of thing. So I feel like that's another issue as well, that comparison.
Yes. You know, I think that's a good piece. If we go back to something you said a moment ago of, this just isn't a transient kind of, oh, come on, get over it, you know, look at how good you are kind of thing. It's almost like we used to look at shyness. We say, you know, just come on, just come out of your shell, or just, you know, look how well you did it. So that's going to kickstart somebody out of a place that they might have felt stuck or kind of turtled away a little bit because of the fear. This is real. And this is very impacting. It can affect one's promotions. It can affect one's work performance. And most sadly, is what you're saying, is that, well, it can also lead into, you know, maybe unhealthy relationships. But ultimately, it really can stagnate and maybe hide one's truest potential because of the deep fear around this. And the comparison piece is interesting, like you're raising up. You know, an introvert might say, well, you know, I can't speak like that, so therefore I have nothing to contribute. Or maybe, you know, I'm really good in the clinical field, and but, you know, they're good in stats, and so they're really good. So we basically throw the baby out with the bathwater and say they're better than we are and we are less than. Mm-hmm. That's a shame.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of the reading and stuff I've kind of like to try to understand this a little bit better is this. There's some theories that this is rooted in childhood and messages that we get, you know, from early on. And it's almost like two extremes of messaging. One is that you really aren't that bright, you know, kind of a message that, you know, you, whether that comes from early school years or early home life, that, you know, you're really not the star here. Even though you may become a star, you still don't believe it because it's so kind of instilled in you. And that's how you've sort of built, people have reacted to you. And then therefore, that's how you just learn to react in the world. And then the other extreme being like, oh, you're the greatest, you can do anything. And then without really having proven that, I mean, everybody, we all have to kind of test ourselves a little bit. And so maybe giving the message that, you know, hey, you're the greatest, you don't have to lift a finger to do that kind of thing. And so then I think both of those camps can kind of lead to that feeling of like, wait a minute, I, how did I end up here? You know.
We'll be right back after word from our sponsor.
Continuing education is both a requirement and a learning opportunity, but finding the right CE provider can be challenging. AATBS, a triad company, offers continuing education for psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, counselors, and behavior analysts. CE courses are available both individually and as part of our new All Access Pass. All Access Pass provides a library of over 250 unique courses. That's more than 800 hours of CEs, with new courses being added every month. As a special offer, Behavioral Health Today listeners can save 15% on CE purchases. Visit us at aatbs.com/BHT and enter promo code BHT15 during checkout. That's aatbs.com/BHT. Check out our library and check off your CE requirements today.
You're talking about something that's such a key thing. In fact, I just brought it back up. Psychologically, we know that that's called how our conditions can really shape. One of the interesting studies they did was a study by Rosenthal and Jacobson, where they showed that a children's performance was enhanced if the teachers were led to expect enhanced performance from children. By the same token, if the teachers were led to expect lower performance from children, then the children's performance was diminished. And so the authors from this study were able to support the hypothesis that performance can be positively or negatively influenced by the expectations of others. The observer expectancy effect is what they talked about. And these biased expectations can truly affect the reality and create self-fulfilling prophecies. So what you're talking about in this, that I think is such a nice thing. So basically what they did, they took two classrooms and told one teacher, man, you've got the tough kids this year, you know? And this is a group from last semester or last year that we know don't perform all that well. And good luck. They had another class where they said to teachers, you know, you are so fortunate because this is the group that tends to do really well. You got a great year. Both classrooms were relatively the same. Mm-hmm. And this expectations that were set caused the behaviors on the teacher's part to really shape the outcomes of the classroom. Isn't that phenomenal? So what you're saying, even in our early lives, our early influence, family environments, for example, can truly shape this self-fulfilling prophecy that we live out what we're told about who we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just think too, it sort of speaks to that, the gray, the middle road, the middle path. Yeah. I as a parent or a teacher express my love for the student or child or care for the child as like, you're the best, you are perfect, you can't do anything wrong. Or the other end of like, you're no good, like, but hey, you're great and I love you, but here's a chance to grow, you know, like, and like, let's be realistic, you know, and to pick that middle path, you know, if, what benefit that could be.
I think that was something that really was a failure on the side of mental health for a while, where we were telling kids, you know what, you are worth it and you're doing good and you're just, everybody gets a trophy idea. That is the most handicapping thing that can happen because a child inside knows that trophy that they were given was not based on their merit. Mm-hmm. It was almost better to lose that tournament or that game or that position and to learn from it. Like you just said in the middle, what can we learn from this? We're either winning or we're learning and we're growing. And so what if we were to learn from that and develop this sense of self that's actually really honest and how to work hard? Because we can actually handicap kids, can't we? If we're saying, you know, you're all that and, you know, you're going to be the best. And that doesn't build self-esteem. That just builds actually some real fear. Maybe and maybe some of the development of the imposter syndrome.
Yeah. You know, that was a little bit of what was frustrating to me about reading about imposter syndrome or, you know, imposter phenomenon, that some of the answers or solutions and were like, oh, eat better, eat more vegetables, get more sleep.
Eat better, get more vegetables, and get more sleep, and your imposter syndrome will be gone. That's very funny.
I know. Yeah. So then I started thinking, well, if I get on there and say this, then I'm really going to be, they're going to really know that I'm going to.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Well, I know that there are some things we can do, and I want to talk about that in just a second, but I want to talk about one of the pieces because you're around a variety of people, a variety of ages. You know, I know you're working with the Catholic Church, as we mentioned earlier in our introduction. You're in the prison systems. You're in a homeless shelter. You know, you're doing all kinds of students. You're just kind of wide swath of people in your life. But amidst all of that, there's this social media impact as well. Have you noticed anything around the social media aspects of this imposter syndrome maybe forming for some folks?
It's amazing, to be honest. So just the other day in class, one of the students was talking about some of the children, younger children that they're seeing in their field placement, and that the messages that kids are getting through those, like about looks, about sports stuff, like the things that are out there are so big comparison. Just, I feel like this is one big comparison situation for, like, you know, we were talking a minute ago about like trying, if I'm comparing myself to faculty that are on a tenure track versus whatever, that can set me up. And I just think that kids aren't exposed to, hey, look at that. Look, they look great because they've got some, filter on their computer or whatever. But I do think that's just a big issue. I think the comparison factor is gigantic. And, you know, kids learn from what social learning theories, you know, that you learn from what you see. And if I'm seeing perfection for 5 minutes from somebody versus their whole life or their whole way they really are, then that's what I'm going to start comparing myself to. And I can't live up to that, to the 5 minute snippet or the 2 minute or 3 second snippet that I'm seeing of perfection on that person, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. It's really It's really such a distorted lens, isn't it? And yet we don't question it, or we maybe don't know how to question it. Or, you know, there's that sense of FOMO, fear of missing out, you know, where folks are seeing other people have all these great lives. And I guess my life is just kind of dull and ordinary and just regular. And I must not be all that, you know, and these, then these messages become part of our narrative are just so, so telling. I know that there are some ways, let's just shift a little bit. You know, the funniest thing, we're talking about the imposter syndrome. I got to tell you, this is the story that comes to mind. There's this little quick saying that says, you know, I'm trying to be the person that my dog thinks I am. And it talks about that idea. It talks about that idea, you know, where other people can see us in ways that we may not see ourselves, and our dogs kind of being unconditionally accepting. But other people can really be a part of maybe a way of working out of this. And I believe that with any problem, first we need to recognize that, yeah, you know, maybe I, for lack of a better term, maybe I suffer from this. It's not just shyness, or it's not just a little bit of self-doubt. Maybe it's something significant that I need to actively name and maybe actively address. Let's talk a little bit about maybe some ways that we can kind of lean into this. And it's almost like I have a sense of, this is who I am, but my fear shrouds my true identity. And you're talking about kind of removing this lie and emancipating this self that has the ability to emerge. And I want to kind of lean into that a little bit. Talk about some thoughts about how do we get the shroud off, and maybe how can that emancipation process take place?
Ooh, that's huge. To me, the word that comes up is authenticity. The analogy of like, I'm disguised as a tiger in a cage with a bunch of other tigers, scared to death, they're going to figure out, like, you know, how can I remove the disguise and just, hey, look, this is who I really am. I'm not a tiger, whatever, however you, of course, that could put your life in danger, but like that's the feeling that your life is going to be in danger. I think that when we have this to the full extent, that like, I am scared that my life's going to be in danger in some way, or I'm going to be exposed and it's going to be humiliating and that kind of thing. So I think that just that maybe steps towards authenticity, like this is really who I am. I'm going to tell a couple of people that I'm really unsure about my role here. I really don't know if I know enough. Is there that safe person? Who is that safe person that I can reveal that to? And then you see there's an acceptance and an engagement, and then the next person, it gets easier. Easy to be said.
I think that's really key. I would imagine, Reagan, in some of the positions you're in, both as a professor at the doctor level that you're at in your own training. So I would imagine the classroom, I would imagine your trainings. I know you do workshops. I also know you're in the prison systems. And all of those environments, from, if we were just to look at a range, just for example, from the prison systems all the way to, you know, academia, it's fraught with those that are going to be experiencing an imposter syndrome. How do you use your relationship with all the people in this range of involvement you have with them? What are some of the ways that you use yourself to maybe mirror back to them what you're seeing that might be the beginnings of challenging, I don't see myself that way, Reagan. I see myself as, and then how do you find yourself leaning into that once you kind of hold this up to them and mirror that back?
You know, not that I'm any kind of pro, but like, I feel like that my own journey of trying to find an authentic self in me has made me, I think about myself when I was young in my 30s and then trying to be something that was everybody wanted or whatever. And then getting into a little bit of work of my own tunic and just like how I feel so differently and how I kind of own who I am and own my weaknesses and that kind of thing. And I think that's opened up my heart in a way that, of course, it's not perfect, but like just that's opened my heart. I think my own work has allowed me to try to be more authentic with other people. And then I think that if we're able to do that, then I think then other people can follow suit. You know, I really do believe that. I really have felt that, you know?
I think that where you're talking about leading with vulnerability, being able to say, yeah, I get it. I've been there. Here's maybe what I experienced. And that begins to kind of soften, I think, one's ability to be receptively, you know, taking in the things you're saying and maybe them even saying, you know what, that's me, or I felt something very similar. And then you get a little bit of a door to lean into and maybe address something in them that's really important. But just maybe, you know, we're talking about the fear piece. Well, around this imposter syndrome, there's also a sense of helplessness against it. Like I feel kind of powerless to do much.
It's a belief. Like, I mean, if I'm believing something, it's true. You know, it's like I am not worthy. So then how is that challenged? You know, one night I was with some people from other faculty members, and we went down this path of just telling goofy stories of silly things that we, bad mistakes we'd made and goofy things that we'd done. And I'm telling you, like, here are these people that were like, I had on like the PhD level. Oh man, they were no better. They were goofy like me. And so like that was so cool. I loved that idea. Like, I wonder if we should do that, like do that more, like just set up opportunities for us to tell the goofy things we've done and then realize, look, we're all here together. We're all grounded here together, you know?
Well, I think that's the start of something, isn't it? But we get to kind of normalize that we're all a bit quirky. We're all a bit weird. We're all a bit nutty, you know, we all are doing the best we can. So there's kind of a normalization of that. And then you're saying, it's not just me, it's everybody else. So there's kind of this universality that, you mean it's not just me? Because I think a lot of times when we're working out of fear and shame, being scared of humiliation, all the things you're citing here, we stay very small and siloed, and we stay kind of in secret about these things. We don't, the last thing we want to do is to talk about, hey, I have this, you experience it? Because that's going to be the very thing that would out us as, oh, maybe they're not all that we thought that person was.
I think with a sense of humor and a sense of like, you know, just a collegiality, you know, and I think that's, but it is, I think part of it's kind of like, I feel like if I'm living in this, this imposter syndrome, then there's a fear of letting the wall down a little bit, you know, but if I could take the lead or someone, you know, if we could take the lead, and I'm gonna let my wall down a little bit and show you, look, hey, I'm not that what maybe you might think I'm or something like that. Then I think that's going to open a door to it. You know, it's interesting when I think about my own sort of relationship with this concept. It's interesting when I teach to a large group, or if I'm speaking to a larger group, I feel a little bit more confident. But if I'm in a therapeutic situation, I get this. This is real in a way for me, from a one-on-one, like this one person looking at just me, we're the only two, I can't hide behind anything. Then that's to me is a little bit scarier to me. So it's taken a lot more work. I don't know if that made sense.
It makes great sense. It sounds like it feels a little more exposed. There's no role to hide behind, like you might have in a professor role. Maybe in the therapeutic role, it's more human to human. And it's a little bit more gritty and therefore a little bit more vulnerable. How do you manage that? What do you do with that?
I think that there's a paradox here. That I think when I'm sitting with one-to-one with the other person in sort of a helping situation, then even though I feel myself as being unworthy and unable to do the best CBT or the best whatever family thing that I'm doing, but really, I think ironically, I'm putting myself above the person. I'm here to fix you. And then you see me as this, so I need to stay up here and pretend that I am this. But if I can realize I'm just a human being here, and that, like, I just want to relate to you and be with you. And I think that's the healing factor. Anyway, do you see what I'm saying? Like, it's a weird paradox of, like, I see myself negatively, but I see myself negatively because I think I'm supposed to be above this person I'm working with, which is so false.
Well, I would imagine that in your training of, you know, upcoming colleagues, professionals in this field, we get to realize that at the end of the day, we're all human, and it's going to be that initial bridge of our humanness. You know, Carl Rogers talks about warmth, empathy, and genuineness being the three keys that kind of help begin to bridge things. And that's just being one human going through life. And now we're kind of sojourners, you know, in this thing called life. And I get to come alongside you per your invitation or per my role with you. But at the same time, you've also been trained at the doctoral level, and the students you're training in your clinical social work program now at the University of Tennessee, they have special skills, you know, that can really help people through the various areas that they're stuck in their lives. So that you have a way out, but you have a humanness about the connection. That's kind of the conduit for some of these strategies and maybe techniques to help people get unlocked from the places where they're stuck. So there's a proper humility there versus maybe kind of an imposter syndrome feeling.
I love the way you put that. I love the way you put that.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of, you're a very approachable guy and you're very safe. And at the same time, you're also very bright. So there's the both things. You know, you mentioned, as we talk about this, the importance of someone coming, it's almost like an addiction where our first step is to recognize that I'm powerless over my addiction. using that just as a model for conversation, we get to say, you know what, maybe I feel like I'm powerless over this imposter syndrome. I can't seem to shake it no matter what success I have. I'm only as good until my next exposure. And that might be the time when Reagan finds out about. So first of all, we got to name it. And then you talked about kind of slowing everything down and breathing. And then you mentioned something about trying to find maybe someone that you might trust to share this with. In your classroom, it might be you as a professor saying, hey guys, it will not be a surprise to me if some of you experience what we call the imposter syndrome. As you take on more on of your courses and your practicum roles, your internship, it will come up. And it sounds like what you're saying there is not just naming it, but encourage them maybe to find somebody to talk with and almost give them what their family of origin wasn't able to give them. And that goes back to that mirroring relationship. Talk about the roles you think maybe supervisors or teachers or employers, say if others could provide someone as they try and work out of this imposter syndrome to see themselves as to who they really are.
I feel like if we could build a community around it or kind of start building a little community around it, you know, like, hey, look, yeah, I think this is the age old thing that we as humans are just, I mean, we just need each other and we need to be real with each other and the attunement that we can care with one another. I feel like, you know, in teaching, you know, I try to always have a couple war stories or things, you know, that have happened, you know, that students can kind of see like, oh, wow, he's not just talking about it all just from a perfection or, you know, all that kind of thing. I think that's big to me because I think it sort of starts building a community around it. And that was the thing around with us sharing a few nights ago about like just some of the goofy things that had happened to us in our professions. And it just sort of built a connection. And I just think that starting that step. And then I think another thing is that we're all on different parts of the path that like I might be just beginning, but somebody else might be further down. I feel like seeing somebody else just creates hope. And I think a community, and then there's some further down the road, some not, it creates hope. We're trying to drag people into some hope. I'm not an expert now, and that's okay because maybe I will be in a few years or who knows, you know.
I remember when I was doing my training, even in the classroom, before I went on to do some training and internship and fellowship, I would go back and I would read my professor's evaluations. And they wrote some things, you know, Graham is good in this area and can grow in this area, all things they would say. But I would read those multiple times because they were seeing things in me that I wasn't seeing yet or believing yet, but they were seeing potential. And I would imagine that you would do that with some of the people that you're seeing or maybe some of the people that you work with. You're holding up things to them that, you know, it's weird to go back to what you said earlier. Our families can create almost, so we know about mirroring, parent, child. But if a parent's got a distorted view of their child, then the child has a distorted view of themselves. And then what happens, we go from parent, child to adult, and that distorted view of self with healthy adults can almost have all the dents bent, you know, knocked out of it. And you're talking about maybe helping someone identify their true self. How do you encourage students maybe, or how have you done that with students maybe in your classroom or maybe with some of the people that are incarcerated that you work with that have a very distorted view of themselves?
A ton of things kind of come to mind. I do think that an attempted authenticity of myself, I think, you know, that the fancy word counter-transference, I feel like if I try to be aware of my own, what am I feeling with the person? Like, what am I experiencing truly from this person? Yes. And what am I feeling a sense of doubt about myself. I just feel like that being attuned to that, what am I experiencing in relationship to this person can bring about like an authentic expression of who that other person is. You know, when I very first started working in social work in an alternative sentencing program and was a little bit nervous of the clients. I mean, and I think they must have picked up on that, you know, because they had done some stuff that was, you know, kind of off of my experience level, if that makes sense. And so I'm sure they picked up on that. And so like, I saw other people being honest with the clients, like saying, you know what, hearing what you did does impact me. And like, I think just that honesty sort of showed me, oh, wow, we can do that then. So it's okay to have that feeling, you know, and then it becomes just more real, you know?
Yeah. I love that idea of not just understanding about what we have grown up with, you know, almost like the Rosenthal effect in our family where expectations are laid down and then we become self-fulfilling prophecies of the very things we're told. That's our only sense and knowing or meaning of who we really are. It's basically, it's not about the book not being good enough. It's that I'm not good enough. Or it's not, you know, necessarily the crime that I committed or the thing that I did or the grade that I didn't get on my exam. I didn't get that because of who I am. And so it all comes back to that sense of, you know, I am something in the negative category. So I love this idea. I know we're kind of winding down here, but I want to kind of toss out the things I'm gathering that you're saying is we got to recognize it. And then we got to kind of pause and kind of own it with our own vulnerability. And then maybe begin to try and find some safe others. Maybe it's you as a professor for somebody, or maybe it's you as a therapist that, you know, someone might be seeing you in, or those that are listening that might be in their own work, or have a safe other to be able to take this to them and say, hey, I think I'm struggling with this and I don't have a rule. And then to ask another question. And I love when we get to encourage folks to say, hey, ask some people, how do they experience you? This is a power, I think, of groups. Do you run much group work or do much group work in your practice?
My favorite. I love groups. I love groups. I'm not doing it currently, but like I just love groups because of what I was saying a second ago, that like kind of that agenda group, like an ongoing group that you see somebody that's maybe further down the road in recovery as a, you know, and then, and that, hey, look, I have some hope that I can get through this. And that again, that just, you know, we're building a community around it, you know, and that what I'm doing in the group can mirror who I am and how do different people perceive me. And I think it's some accurate input on that. I just think that I love a group.
I think that input, that mirroring, that sense of normalizing certain things, the idea of hope that, hey, wait a minute, your story is my story. You're just further down the road. If you're down the road, maybe I can get down the road. So there's that hope that comes up in that piece as well. And there's an acceptance in groups that make it, if they run well, there's acceptance in groups that says, you can get there too. You know, here's what we see you so far. And it begins to kind of change and help us bang out some of the dents from maybe the things that we've been told about ourselves that we believed all of this time were true and maybe keep us from really experiencing our true self.
I feel like in a way with the group thing that there's an accountability. And, you know, when I think about if I am hiding my true self, if I'm preventing myself from taking a job promotion or because I don't feel strong enough, or I don't feel, if I'm not going to engage with clients because I don't feel good enough, then that's opening up, that's taking me out of the thing. And I might have some really great stuff to give, but my fear is keeping me from doing it, or this thing. So I feel like in a way we kind of owe it to the community or owe it to one another. And I think that accountability thing is really helpful, that we're part of this. That's social justice. I give what I can out of who I really am. And I owe that, I think.
That's so well put. I think that kind of gets us out of the sense of, oh, I haven't got anything to bring. Bananas. No, you don't. You have more than you know that you can bring. I think we've all been given, you know, gifts and talents and skills and abilities. So it's a story of the talents and what you do with them. You know, do you go bury them or do you take them and you multiply them? And the idea is these are qualities that you've been given uniquely, just you. And I need you and you need me to recognize what these are, that are divinely given to me, that it's my responsibility not to define them, but to take them to their fullest potential. So like you said, I can contribute to something larger than myself. And I kind of owe it to you and you owe it to me to find out what those are and to contribute in that way. It goes to social justice. It goes to everything else. And we're in concert together in such a kind of a really lovely, harmonious way. But if we don't do that, we stay small. Oh, man, people are missing out. And I would love our listeners maybe to hear kind of a closing message from you about, hey, don't keep your light under a bushel. Give us a closing message, you know, but maybe some hope about overcoming this idea.
I just think, like what you just said, we are all so unique. And that I may think that what I have to bring or offer isn't that great. And so therefore, I need to hide it somehow. But boy, that authentic self is a gift. It's a gift to be able to share. And I think sometimes when I, like, if I don't feel enough value in myself for what, you know, I'm doing this because I want to feel better or because I deserve to feel better, that if I'm not thinking that or if that's not where I am, then sometimes I can think, well, wow, somebody else needs to hear this too. You know, that I struggle or I deal with this or that I, you know, that other people need to hear it too.
And when we believe that, even if we don't have any data to take a step in that, but if we just believe that maybe someone needs to hear this, if we can take that step, there's a chance that someone's going to come back and say to you, you know what, you may not know this, but I needed to hear that. You go, really?
Yeah.
And then you begin to counter this negative belief that maybe I do have something, but we got to, you know, we don't get brave before we do the thing that scares us. We develop some courage and bravery after we do the thing that scares us the most. But I just love this message that you're kind of holding up for us and taking these steps. Well, you know what? I know we're kind of winding down, but I would love our listeners to be able to follow up with you after our show today. Give us some resources that they can do so, please.
Well, if anybody is interested in pursuing a master's degree in social work, the University of Tennessee, we have it on two campuses and we have it online. It's great. It's just at our University of Tennessee College of Social Work site. There you can see it. And we also have some postgraduate trainings that are there on trauma and on organizational leadership and on school social work. There's all kinds of stuff that's there. So I love our college and kind of what we're doing. So
that's awesome. That's great. Well, Reagan, my friend, it's always great to have you with us. I love your humanness. I love your humor. I love your passion for these things. And I love your love for people. And your messages are always encouraging ones. And it's always great to be here. Thanks for being back on our show today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me so much. I'm an avid listener. It's really neat to be a part of this. Thank you.
I sure appreciate your participation and all your contributions to it. I also want to thank you, our listeners, for joining Reagan and me today. It's always great to have you with us. Regarding our episode, I want to remind you that it and its resources and all of our other episodes can be found on our webpage at triadhq.com/BHT. Thanks again for being with us on the show, and we'll look forward to having you back with us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.